how can you wrap up education with entertainment? That's the key. Because if only a handful of people watch it, it ain't working. You should be a hobby of yourself. You should be an all-consuming hobby. Work on you like you are looking after your body for somebody else. If your body could choose what it wanted to eat and drink, what would it choose? So it's me going, I love the biscuit base. I love the buttery biscuit base. And when I first saw it, I thought, that is absolute genius.
Hello and welcome to the Experts in Health podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast aims to highlight the latest research and trends in health as we welcome a variety of guests from a host of different disciplines. I'm Dr. Chris McLeod, an academic in the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences with an expertise in behavioural nutrition and public health. And today I'm delighted to be joined by the one and only Greg Wallace, MBE. Greg is an entrepreneur, a media personality, a writer and a former greengrocer, which I love that one. But he's also likely best known in the UK as a familiar face on our TV screens over the last two decades. Greg, it's wonderful to have you here today. Thanks so much for coming on.
Absolutely delighted to be. I'm very impressed by your intro. Are you on auto cue there, or did that off the top of your head?
That's off the top of my head.
Mate,
yeah.
That is very impressive. A lifetime in telly, that is very impressive.
Bless you. Well, it's been a joy to have you already, because the number of jokes that you are able to crack off the cuff, I can only just do that intro without laughing. So thanks for coming. It's been great. It's great to have you already.
There is anyone who's worked with me knows that I do this. And actually, if you think about it, all the jokes are clean. None of them are political. And the reason I do it is it keeps my energy up and it makes for a happy, relaxed environment. There you go.
Oh, well, I feel it.
There's a method. There's a method behind all the junk.
Well, it is, yeah, great to have you. We're going to be talking a little bit about your expertise, your involvement in health very broadly, but we'll hopefully get into a few little bits and bobs. But we're here today on the Loughborough University campus because you're doing a little bit of work with Loughborough University. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm really, really proud of my association with Loughborough University. Loughborough University are the academic research partner for my weight loss and health business, Greg Wallace Health. They contacted me. I had no idea. And they were really complimentary and said, look, your system for weight loss is sustainable and healthy. We'd like to investigate. Have you got an academic partner? Well, I had no idea what that was. So I'm really proud of my association with Loughborough. I work with Amanda Daly, very clever, very tough, but smiley, lots of energy. And her team research the members of Greg Wallace Health and track their weight loss and stuff, which is absolutely brilliant. Now, I'm a boy out of a council estate and I left school without a single qualification. And I had to address a room of about, you were in it.
I was.
You were in it. I mean, how many professors in that room? About 50. I was so nervous. I've done television and live stuff all of my life. I was so nervous that day.
I remember you saying that. Yeah, which was surprising because you do, you know, you are everywhere on TV. People know you. People know you in a particular sort of really able to communicate way. But yeah, that situation, not your norm.
No, because I couldn't tell gags. I wasn't tasting anybody's sandwich. It was completely out of my comfort zone.
Well, you could have, but it wasn't what you were there directly for.
No, and I just had some handwritten notes, and you guys grilled me.
Well, we'll get on to the sort of the little ins and outs of what you're doing with Loughborough in a little bit later on. But just to help us set the scene, can you tell us where this all started for you? A little bit about your background, all the way up to your sort of greengrocer days. It'd be really interesting.
Wow. Okay. All right. Fine. Well, I'm a bloke and a telly presenter, so I'm really happy talking about me.
Yeah, go on.
This
podcast is the Greg Wallace podcast, right, so we want to hear about it.
Well, I'm born into rented accommodation with my grandparents living upstairs. I was an only child until I was 10 years old. It sounds Dickensian. We had an outside toilet and no bathroom. We used to bath at my grandmother's house once a week. So pretty poor upbringing, but a happy upbringing. And I actually did okay at school. And I went to a grammar school. It was my first introduction to rugby. I'm a big rugby fan. And just played up terribly. And just left school with absolutely no qualifications. Left home as well. around the age of 15, actually kind of got asked to leave school. Just messed everything up. And then kind of realised at 16, 17, that my prospects were small and it began to trouble me. And I just did a number of jobs, minicab driver, scaffolding, labouring, and got a job in Covent Garden Market, fruit and veg market. And everything changed. Absolutely. All I was after was a job to pay the bills, perhaps buy a flat. This, you know, this is the Thatcher era. Everybody's buying properties. This is the thing to do. Desperate to just have enough money to have a deposit and buy a flat. And actually found that I really loved the market environment. Let me paint a picture of the market, because I don't want to give anybody mislead anybody. I never had a stall. Okay, Covent Garden Market is wholesale. We were involved in catering supply, which meant we sent trucks out every day to supply the restaurants. Mm-hmm. I never had got a chance to shout out lovely aubergines, tell your mum, or call me a saint, call me a sinner, call it a tenner, and ruder ones.
Your voice would be good for that sort of oration. But
yeah. Guaranteed to bake or fry, make a pudding or a pie. None of that. Didn't get to do any of that. It was wholesale. And at that point, I thought, I need to develop me as a person and I need to develop some sort of career. And I had a go at being a salesman. And it turned out I was okay at it. And I ended up with a loyal following of chefs, restaurants, and till I had enough to start my own business. I had no idea how to run a business. But I learned pretty quickly through making mistakes. So consequently, I ended up with a sizable business. I started my greengrocer business in October 89. I was 26 years old. By the time I'm in my 30s, we're running 15, 16 trucks out of Covent Garden every day, and we're doing £7.5-8 million a year in fruit and veg, and this is back 80s. I'm now supplying fruit and veg to all of the named chefs, all of them. I was good at it. And I was doing work with local growers because I wanted more local and seasonal produce, and this is 25, 30 years ago. And a trade magazine called The Hotel and Caterer did an article on me. And the freelance journalist who did the article did work for Radio 4's food programme. Went back and told Sheila Dillon, who ran the food programme, about me. She phoned up, said, we'd like to do a programme with you following fruit and veg from the grower to your wholesale business out to one of your restaurants. We want to follow. So I pulled in my posh mate, Charlie Ickes, who worked for me. People thought we were partners, or I worked for him because he was posh. I love him dearly. We lost him a couple of years ago, sadly. So I pulled Charlie in because he was more of a voice of Radio 4, and they loved us together. They it was obvious we were very close. It was obvious there was a real contrast in our voice. They gave us our own radio show called Veg Talk on Radio 4, and that ran for about 6 years. And then the telly came sniffing around.
So before we come to the telly stuff, why fruit and veg? Was it just the opportunity that came in front of you when you were looking for a job? Or were there things before that that made you lead into that?
No. I just answered an advert in the Evening Standard newspaper for a warehouseman. Yeah. And I talked to the guy on the phone, and Alf Rogers, the foreman. And I went up there and he'd interviewed other people, but he had my name written down. Obviously impressed him somehow on the phone. He had my name written down in his pocket because he showed it to me because he offered me the job. And I started as a warehouseman in Covent Garden Market. I mean, I just loved, the colours, I loved the smells, yeah. I loved the banter. It was just so much energy. Yeah. You know, it's 3-4 o'clock in the morning in the rest of London, but there, it's lunchtime. Like, the pubs are open, the cafes are open. And it was just energy. And it was a business that wasn't difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. You had to make friends with chefs. It seemed quite easy to understand.
Yeah, and is there anything from your background, your upbringing, childhood, into your teenage years that you would have thought, if you were presented what you've done now, that there was an inkling that you might start up your own business, become a personality on the TV, start up a health and fitness company? Any inkling at all?
Yeah, I've always had quite a bit of confidence, and I've always liked people. And I think throughout my career, whether that had been business or radio or television, it's been people. If you look at the jobs I do on television, it's talking to people. I like doing that. I'm interested in people. And also, I firmly believe that you can learn anything don't ever be scared to ask questions. If you don't understand, don't sit there not understanding. So that's business or food, food styles, food techniques, business acumen. Just ask. Just ask questions. So I've always had a quest for knowledge. But I had a job, my first job when I left school, was in a dry cleaners in Peckham. And I set up a dry cleaning round where I would collect dry cleaning from people on Ryle. You know Ryle Estate. You know it through Only Fools and Horses. You know it as Nelson Mandela House. It's actually Ryle Estate. And I would clean the stuff in my lunchtime and deliver it back. And then I had a window cleaning round. Mm-hmm. And then I used to paint people's set. So I've always had this entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah. And then TV comes knocking after the radio. What was that first opportunity and how did that come about?
We had a radio show, so people were aware of us, me and Charlie, and then we started getting invited onto daytime and morning television shows that didn't pay very much at all to discuss fruit and veg or food or maybe cook something, and it started that way. And then I got a phone call. I didn't have an agent back then. And then I got a phone call from someone at the BBC, so we'd like to talk about a programme idea. And it was actually Saturday Kitchen. I was the first ever presenter of Saturday Kitchen. That was the bit. That was the big break. So now I've got radio.
Back in, when was that? What year are we talking now? Early 2000s, is it? Or was it late 90s?
Well, hang on. So MasterChef is 20 years old. So what does that make it? So when did that start? 20 years?
2004.
So we're looking at around 2000. 2002, 2003.
And then from that, MasterChef was out there next?
Yeah, well, extraordinary, actually. And now I've got an agent, and she phoned me up. She said, there's a company called Shine. They're in Kensington. They're a serious production company. They're making a food show, and I have no idea what it is, but they would like to see you. I've set up an interview for you. So I went down there, and there's a lady called Karen Ross, who ended up being my boss on MasterChef for 10 years. Tough lady, clever lady. Friend now, but tough. And she sat across the table like you are now, and she had a camera like where your guys are now. And she said to me, tell me about food. And I said, anything. She said, anything you like. And I think I spoke for about 45, 50 minutes without taking a break. And she said, all right, stop. She said, come with me. She smoked. I smoked back then, I think. And she said, I'm remaking MasterChef. She said, it's going to be about 3 months filming. We start filming in 2 weeks. I'd like you. Can you do it? It's going to be about three. I was like, yeah, I'll do it.
No second thoughts?
No, not at all.
Felt right. The right time, right opportunity.
Yeah. Not at all. I was like, yeah, absolutely, I can do it. She said, I've got a chef as a judge. I want a judge who's not a chef, and I want you. And I said, who's the chef judge? She said, oh, you won't know him. He's an Australian guy called John Terode. And then she looks at me, she said, do you know him? I said, he's been buying veg off me for about 10 years.
Because you've been making friends with chefs for the last time.
Because I've been making friends, yeah. So John and I were never great mates back then. So they put us together, but we knew each other enough to be comfortable with each other. Mm. Yeah. And then, of course, a great relationship started. And that was it. I mean, it just didn't stop. It was like MasterChef ended up being a big hit in its first series, followed by Celebrity MasterChef, followed by Pro MasterChef. And it just kept on, it kept on coming.
Amazing. A gift that has kept on giving. What are the most memorable things for you? So have you got any instances where it continues to make you laugh? You know, really memorable moments, either behind the scenes or...
There's Cheryl Baker on Celebrity MasterChef, and there were a couple of minutes to go, and she wanted to do like crepe Suzette, so she had to set light to it. So you have to put the liquid in the pan, you have to get the heat up, at the right moment, you then... And just in panic, lit the match and then emptied the bottle of booze over her hand.
right.
No flame. Luckily. And Midure Ultravox, first series. Back then, production didn't think that Celebrity MasterChef should be humorous. They thought it might dilute the seriousness of the competition. Nowadays, we understand that's real entertainment. Mm. And this didn't make it past the edit, but it would now. The chef was explaining to Midure the dish a number of times, and he said, do you understand this now, Midge? and with his arms out said, "It means nothing to me," which didn't make it in. So those of you who are too young who are listening, that's obviously Vienna, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you don't remember, you're probably too young.
I know of Midge, but I don't know the
name. Ah, right, okay, you're so old like me. And a lot of the stuff that's funny I couldn't repeat right now.
Yeah,
I love stuff behind the scenes with me and John.
But you have to taste a lot of lovely food. I'm sure there's some food that you go, that's not quite hit the mark. But you had a lot of lovely food. And in that period of time, did you notice that eating a lot of lovely food had an impact on your health in any way?
It never really was MasterChef. If you have a look, there's a lot of food, but you have to remember that we're only taking a mouthful. So even if we eat a dozen plates, even if we taste a dozen plates of food, we're going to have 12 mouthfuls.
Mm.
That's probably a dish and a half.
Yeah.
The danger actually comes towards the final when you only have quality contestants left.
And
the food just gets better and better.
And three courses.
And you can find yourself demolishing the whole lot.
Yeah.
The problem was what I was doing after filming.
Okay.
So I would then go to the pub. And then I'd go for dinner. And then wine, whiskies, like food. And then eating takeaways and snacking during the day. It wasn't the tasting itself. I often get asked that question, how can you be slim surrounded by all that food? But you're just tasting.
Yeah, that's interesting. But you still went on a personal health journey quite recently, and you know, now you're ripped. What happened? What made you decide, I actually need to get in better shape here, I need to think about my health and fitness? What happened?
There were two things that coincided. One was a press shot of me and my mate John Tarode in India. And he looked well. And I had a beige suit on with a shirt, and my belly and shirt were just hanging over my trousers, and my face was big and puffy, and I really didn't like it. And I'd been watching myself on the television getting bigger and bigger and not liking what I was seeing at all. And at the same time, my doctor did a blood test, cholesterol count, and phoned me up and said, "You've got to come and see me. Your cholesterol is through the roof. If we don't do something right now, you are going to be very, very unwell." So those two things coincided, and I thought, right, okay, time to really have a look at my diet and my lifestyle.
And what did you then do to find out the regime that you were going to follow or the changes that you were going to make to your lifestyle? Because there's loads out there. You could have gone, I'm sure, to a friend of yours that you might know that had like a particular way of doing it, but there's so many out there. How did you decide on the one that you went on, and what was that?
Well, funny enough, it was calorie counting, right? But then I did Weight Watchers and was successful on Weight Watchers. But I had a lucrative deal with Weight Watchers where I got so much money to sign on and a bigger amount of money if I achieved the weight loss goal. Well, somebody standing in front of you with a bag of cookies and a burger, and then somebody standing beside them with a chest of gold coins. It was an easy decision to make. If you took all the obese people in Britain and you offered them the same deal, you would have a lot of healthy people. There was a financial inducement. But actually, I couldn't maintain that. I lost the weight and I couldn't maintain that. It was when I started looking at calories, funny enough, and I don't promote calorie counting, not now. It's easier. But when I started looking at calories, there was something. I was down in Hastings because I wanted to lose weight. I thought, right, calorie counting and my Fitness Pal app.
Yeah.
And I was down in Hastings and I had some shellfish off of a shellfish stall, and then just put the calories in. I thought, there aren't any. Hang on a moment, there aren't any. And then I looked at a cod fillet and realised I could probably eat 9. Cod fillets as opposed to a fried, battered one. And I thought, hang on a minute. And I started looking closely at other food types. And I was like, right, okay. So I can eat 3 fillet steaks or 2 fillet steaks for the calorie count of a sirloin. I can eat 2 sirloins for the calorie count of a ribeye. I can have a pile of new potatoes, but can't have many roast potatoes. Okay, I can work this out. I can actually work this out. And I did.
Yeah.
I really worked it out. Then I realised the snacks weren't worth it. and the takeaways were horrendous in the calorie cap. So it started to change, and then because I was a boozer, I then also managed to get a grip of my drinking, and I actually did that through my beautiful wife, Anna, who has taught me a lot. Her family are Southern Italian, and they have a Southern Italian approach to alcohol, which is very, very different to a British approach. So that was a key for me as well.
What is that difference, just to spell it out for our listeners?
Yeah, if you don't mind. I mean, we talk about a Mediterranean diet, actually, but of course there's the European side of the Mediterranean, there's the African side. I call it the garlic belt. You know, you've got Portugal, Spain, France, Italy, right? The garlic belt. And that is Southern Europe. And their approach to food and drink seems very, very different to the north of Europe. So south of Europe, warm, historically agricultural. The north of Europe, cold, historically first to industrialise. There's a very different approach to the drink. So my wife, when we first started dating, out of interest, not nagging, said to me, when you start drinking, do you know when you're going to stop? And that just amazed me. I said, do you? She was like, yes, of course. Now, and I said, you have to explain this to me. So I spend a lot of time in Italy, but if you go France, Spain, it's exactly the same. It's okay to have a drink whenever you want. It's just not okay to be drunk. And what I learned from my wife, and that's what I do now, is she has a very clear idea before she starts drinking alcohol where she wants to get to. And she really considers the effect that every drink is having on her, which is now what I do, so that you know when you've got to where you want to be. And it's always the same when I coach people now, health and weight loss. It's always the same. We want that feeling of relaxation or maybe even euphoria. Well, everybody's got their own. Mine's the second drink. Now, I used to drink at the same pace thinking I was going to prolong that nice feeling, but you don't. You go somewhere else. You go somewhere, so by the fourth, fifth drink, you're repeating the stories. By the seventh drink, you're argumentative. By the tenth, you're singing. And by the twelfth, you're crying. I mean, so now I get to the second slowly, and then I really slow down the drink and I stay in a happy place. So I still drink, but nowhere near as much as I did.
You're being seemingly more mindful about what you're drinking and eating now. You're thinking about it more intentional with what you're putting into your body, when, how much. And this is something that you're now trying to translate and have done successfully into something that's an opportunity for others. And it started off with Show Me Fit, is that right? And was that sort of a COVID pandemic time that came about? Can you tell us a bit more about Show Me Fit? What is it?
Yeah.
For those who don't know.
Well, it's not Show Me Fit anymore. It's morphed into Greg Wallace Health. We're almost 4 years down the line with this business. What happened was COVID hit, the pandemic hit, and I was, same as everybody else, locked indoors. Well, you lock a workaholic up in a house. I mean, something's going to give, right? So I was doing the shopping and the cooking for the family, and I was standing in queues in the supermarket once or twice a week, meeting the same people. And I was talking about how I couldn't get out and earn, and how, you know, I couldn't be furloughed because I was freelance. And they told me, or I began to have discussions with people, that actually online businesses were doing really, really well because shops went. I thought, okay, what can I do? What can I do? And at the time, there was a lot of press interest about my weight loss. And so I sat in my office with A4 pads, marker pens, different color biros, highlighter pens, and tried to write out the program explaining how it is I'd lost weight.
How much weight did you lose?
5 stone.
Yeah.
And by then I was really into my exercise, I thought it would be diet and exercise, so I called it FIT. Mm. Show Me Fit. I then realised, as I started trying to help people, that actually the fitness part of it, the exercise part of it, doesn't really come in until you are almost at your goal weight. I'd kind of forgotten that.
And why is that? What is the difference in focusing mostly on food, let's say, and that's this one side, rather than exercise?
Yeah, I will say that, but just having FIT in there was scaring people. And I'd say, Yeah. So nothing makes overweight people nervous. There's two things. One is the fear that they're going to be hungry, and the other one is the thought they have to exercise. Mm-hmm. and they've always got bad knees, and that's why they can't. And you don't have to exercise to lose weight. You simply don't have to. I interviewed Dr. Giles Yeo a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about how ridiculous it would be to try to lose weight through exercise. So he gave an example. If you eat a chocolate bar, 250 calories, you'd have to be on a treadmill for 30, 40 minutes. That's without the takeaway pizza. That's without the half bottle of rosé wine. That's without the packet of chocolate biscuits on the sofa. There's no way with a bad diet you can treadmill it away. Mm. I say to people, go into any gym at any time. Don't get me wrong, there are huge benefits to exercise. Huge benefits to exercise. Weight loss isn't really one of them, right? So you go to any gym at any time, you will see people in tracksuits on treadmills. Some of them are overweight, some of them are slim. What do you think the difference is, guys? What do you think? They're both on treadmills in tracksuits. What do you think the difference is, what they're eating? So I know that exercise makes overweight people nervous because I've been coaching people free of charge, one-on-one for almost 4 years. And the reason I did that is I wanted to learn more about the issues surrounding people. So I picked people randomly from Greg Wallace Health and coached them so that I could learn more to see that if my issues when I was overweight were theirs. And although we're all individuals, I tell you what, it's ludicrous how we are all, nearly everybody, is in the same boat. It's ludicrous. Yeah, we're individuals, yes, our stories are slightly different, but the issues are virtually always the same. So the reason I put exercise towards the end is experience over 4 years has taught me that people lose weight through eating the right stuff. When they and it's the same story as me, same story as so many people that I've worked with. When they start to change their body shape and their body size, they feel empowered, they feel in control, and they then start wondering how far they can go. Mm-hmm. So then they start thinking, okay, I've nailed this, I'm losing weight. Can I firm myself up? Mm-hmm. Could I get a six pack? Mm-hmm. Could I have a bum like J-Lo? Like, how do you, you know, if I can go from this to this, can I go from this to this?
Yeah, you know, and you felt that as well.
And that was my journey. Yeah. Yeah, and that's the journey of the people who are trying to lose weight. They start to lose weight, and then they get an interest in exercise. But experience, I'm repeating myself, I know, but experience has taught me that if you mention exercise to somebody really overweight, they just get very scared.
Mm. And you've now had thousands of people go through your, you know, now Greg Wallace Health. And you've had a lot of, you know, what we would call a scientist sort of at the moment, lots of anecdotal evidence that what you're doing is working. But what are you now doing with Loughborough? What is that relationship going to do for Greg Wallace Health?
Oh, first and foremost, it gives us real credibility. Real credibility. You know, most people know me as the cheeky chappy fella off the television. But to actually be standing shoulder to shoulder with such a respected organisation as Loughborough, I mean, personally, I'm incredibly proud. I'm learning a lot, but it gives me and Greg Wallace Health real credibility. But what Loughborough are doing is making an independent study of Greg Wallace Health members. They did some initial tests that we can't publish, and it was very, very encouraging. They want to do more, and I expect they will feed straight back to me on where I need to improve. They've told me straight away areas that I need to improve. I need to be more inclusive of all of society. But I've still, and the two major issues, and they said your members still need help with snacking and meal planning. So they're hitting me straight away with that. But also, they will carry out tests and surveys, and of course their word on this, the figures that we can then publish, you know, they're gold stamped. You know, we may be able to take those to government. We can definitely use them if we wanted to get into the corporate world and look after teams of people and staff members and stuff. So yeah, it's huge, but it's only the beginning. I feel like there may be more. There may be more to come with Loughborough because, you know, you've got some great people here and they got some great ideas on where we could go with it. I'm really happy, really lucky that they contacted me Really proud to be working with them. I think this is just the beginning. Or I hope it is.
Exciting. We'll see where it goes. I remember when you came to visit previously and I was talking to you about, you know where this could go or your passion for where this could go. And I remember we ended up talking a bit about more wider policy level in this, because it can be that some people have the motivation, they want to change, but we know that there are systems, levers, policies that come into play that play a massive factor in why people are a particular body shape or have a particular health status. So for you, on that wider level, we like to ask the tough questions, so this might be a bit too tough a question, but what's wrong with food policy, food industry at the moment in the UK, from your eyes, with the experience you've got?
It's really simple. It's really, really simple, is that not enough people in the UK cook or know how to cook. That's it. That is it in a nutshell. I mean, that's absolutely it. That is the root cause. People say to me all the time, I don't have time to cook, and I never want to embarrass them. But that translates straight to me as, I don't know how, because I know it takes 3 minutes to grill a fish. I know it takes 30 seconds to pour stock into couscous. I know it takes about 3 minutes to soften some onions, garlic, put a tin of tomatoes in for a sauce for pasta. But if you don't know that, you think cooking takes a long time. So you don't attempt it. And there are too many companies giving us far too much grab and go, far too much. It's now typical, not unusual, it's now typical, in my experience of 4 years, that people leave their homes in the morning without having breakfast and without knowing what that breakfast is going to be. But that's okay, because they can grab something. Mm-hmm. It'll be ultra processed, it's likely not to be particularly healthy, and it's likely to be packed full of calories. They're leaving the house without knowing what their breakfast is going to be. They have no idea what their lunch is going to be. And they have absolutely no idea what their dinner is going to be when they get home. So consequently, they look in the fridge. They lack the skills to put stuff together. So they then go to the little mini supermarkets. They're now looking for ultra-processed ready meals, or they're phoning for a takeaway. So society as a whole is spending far too much money on food that is not good for them. And that story just goes on and on and on and on and on. I had a chat today with the team here at Loughborough before I came to see you. And I said, yeah, education. You've got some clever people here. And someone, psychology, went, no. Education is pointless without motivation. I was like, yeah. He said, you've got to motivate people. They've got to get a quick lesson in preparing something quick. That hopefully will inspire them to look further. But it's a lack of cookery. Look, I'm not Sherlock Holmes, right? But you don't have to be a fabled detective to see a clear link between the rise of the snack and takeaway culture and the rise of the obesity issue in the UK. It's so simple, it's staring us in the face. But there's so much conflicting advice out there. So people, I had a guy the other day, he's over 20 stone. And he said, well, I try not to eat after 8 o'clock at night. I was like, right, are you telling me a chicken breast? He was giggling. I said, come on, you're a bright guy. A chicken breast with boiled potatoes and spinach and a sauce is not very good for you at 8:15, but a pizza, a bowl of ice cream and some crisps is okay at 7:35.
Yeah, or 7:59.
Come on, man. He's like, right. It's just people just don't know. So, fasting, which normally means they miss out breakfast, it can't be maintained. Anything uncomfortable cannot be maintained. Yeah. So, you don't have to look at anything else than what you are eating. You don't have to stand on one leg every Shrove Tuesday with your little finger in your ear singing songs in Latin. No. You don't have to do any of that. Just look at what you're eating. But nobody knows how to cook. We've been de-skilling the nation since the end of World War II. Oh, crying out loud.
I'll get
right into this. Yeah.
We could go on for hours with that. And obviously, it's an incredibly important area. So some sort of wide-scale policy change for education of particular basic cooking skills.
I'm not a political animal. And I don't campaign, but if I was going to, it would be for cookery education in schools, because we simply have to do something. Now, if you took an hour a week, I haven't costed this up. I've looked at everything else. I haven't costed this up.
We'll do that work in a bit.
if you made cookery in school, an hour a week compulsory from the age of 5 to the age of 15, you would churn out a nation of cooks. You would. Learning from the age of 5, all that how to peel, chop, cook vegetables, how to blend those with stock to turn them into soup, how to grill a steak, how to grill a fish, how to cook frozen spinach, how to open a tin of lentils. You know, you could do so much in 10 years, an hour a week in 10 years, and nobody would ever have to order a takeaway or a meal deal, which is neither a meal nor a deal, ever again. Ever again. I've got another idea, right? What about this? We can try this, right? We can try this. And I mentioned this today with the team here. If we looked at popular takeaways right now, Chinese, Indian, Thai, we would know, guys here, part of the team, we would pretty much, between us, be able to write at least a 10 or 12 dishes that we expected to find on there. Okay, they come. So we could, right now, write about 5 healthy meals for those takeaways with the ingredients they've already got that would be under 500 calories, that would contain 3 portions of veg.
I posed some questions on social media for fans to ask you some questions. See how you can answer these somewhat concisely so that we can get as many people's question answered as possible. What inspired you to be part of the satirical Miracle Meat documentary, and does it fit into your own views about the meat industry and the affordability of food?
Whoa, that's massive! Right, okay. I mean, there are a number of things that people just do not know about me. So when I look at what's written about me in the paper, I do not recognise the Greg Wallace that they write about. I remember my posh mate Charlie X. I said, I remember him saying to a journalist before, he went, Greg Wallace, he sits at home reading history books, drinking fine wine. What's the matter with you? You've got it wrong. People don't know about me. One, I was a single parent, brought my kids up on my own. 2, I'm a qualified rugby coach. And 3, I'm a very passionate amateur historian. That Miracle Meat, that was Jonathan's. Do you know about Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal? Right, okay.
Tell
it's satire, listeners. Right. Jonathan Swift wrote Gulliver's Travels. He was also an MP during the potato famine in Ireland. And he was just at his wit's end that there was no relief package, there was no government intervention, and he was beside himself with rage. Satire, he wanted something done. He wrote a letter to the Times that they published called A Modest Proposal, where he suggested we breed and eat the Irish like cattle. Of course, the outrage was huge, and a week later, a relief package started. So that was satire. Look, it came to me and they said, I was the only person they spoke to who actually knew about this, and Jonathan Swift, they went, oh, great. The cost of living crisis, we're going to suggest that the poor are cutting bits of their flesh away to be turned into, I was like, that is risky. That is risky. And actually it was acting. Yeah. And people take them and go, well, acting yourself? Yeah, you try it. you have a go. Yeah. So I did it. And it had the biggest impact of anything I've ever done on television. So how do I feel about the cost of food now?
And the meat industry.
I'm a happy carnivore, but I eat far more veg than I ever did. There's many more plants in my, I reckon now 5 out of 7 dinners at home are plant-based. So how do I feel about meat? I feel there's a place for it. I do. I love a lamb chop. I love roast beef. Partial to a chicken. I just think we need to eat less of it. As far as cost of food goes, I think mass production is important. You know, the cost of food has gone up, but I like history. And if you have a look, we are spending less of a proportion of our earnings on food than we've ever done throughout history. And I think that's a good thing, that everybody has access to decent food. Nothing wrong with frozen food, nothing wrong with tin food, very lots and lots wrong with ultra-processed food. And actually, when I coach people to lose weight, this is a happy accident, every single one of them saves money on their shopping through meal planning. If you plan your meals, you have zero food waste, which will have a big impact on your bank balance. It will also have a very big impact on the environment, because food waste is having a very negative impact on the environment. So When you plan your meals, you cut down food waste. There's a saving straight away. You don't buy snacks, enormous saving. You don't buy takeaways, enormous saving. Everybody who meal plans loses weight and saves a fortune on their shopping. So food prices have gone up, but there is a way that you can beat it right now, and that's to start planning. I talk to people and go, do you plan your meals? Plan them. I'm busy planning the meal. I can't on an hour on a Sunday plan. I went, oh, interesting, you haven't got time to. No, I haven't got time to. Interestingly, because you went to the shop 7 times last week. Well, you have got time to meal plan.
Good answer. I'm going to move on to the next one, if that's okay. I hope that was okay, our listener who asked that question. The next one, comparing food programmes on the radio and TV food programmes, how does each of those two media, that medium, have the opportunity to influence the nation to eat more healthily?
Well, yes. Now, I've worked radio and television in food, and Radio 4 in particular always, always commits to quality, like nothing I've ever seen. And I was very, very fortunate to cut my teeth in broadcasting on Radio 4. One of the brilliant things about being on Radio 4 is everybody takes it for granted you're an expert, because that's the high esteem that we hold Radio 4, and they really commit to quality and fairness in a brilliant way. Television and radio can, of course, educate and really, really help here, but I have to say they also have to entertain. It's not just to educate. If it's just education and BBC television or any television channel doesn't get viewing figures, they will become irrelevant. So it's not just education. Mm. How can you wrap up education with entertainment? That's the key. Mm-hmm. 'Cause if only a handful of people watch it, it ain't working. Yeah. Commercial channels won't get advertising revenue. Public broadcasting won't get license fee because they'll be irrelevant. So it has to entertain as well as educate.
We talk about that in science interventions for public health, is you can have an efficacious one, that an intervention that works in the laboratory, in a highly controlled environment, theoretically it's going to change the health of the nation. But if it's not effective when you roll it out in the nation itself, then you haven't got an effective intervention. Similar to what you're saying, education as a tool in a controlled laboratory experiment could present that, but if it's not presented in a way that people are going to engage with, then it's not actually going to work.
Agreed. I mean, how many people did watch Open University at that time of night?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's because there were too many bow ties and sideburns. But that's
there. You go. We'll try that out without that. Two more questions for you. Hopefully, slightly. Easier to answer. What was your favourite factory that you visited in your
easy peasy lemon squeezy? And it went out recently, and that is the Lush soap factory. I don't like the food factory. Remember, I spend 3 days in these factories. Food factories, you have to wear all the PPE. Boots, hair nets, protective clothing. If they're food manufacturing, they invariably are really cold at some point with big refrigeration or freezing, and then they're really hot at some point because they're cooking something, and they are uncomfortable. Not to work in. Yeah. I'm not saying, factory workers, they work this shit, trying to make a television program inside them with the noise, the heat, the cold, the changes of, oh, crikey. But anything that's non-food is a walk in the park. Mm. So the Lush factory, just the fragrances and the colors, and no PPE. No PPE, there was glitter and there were clouds of smoke. I just thought that was absolutely fabulous.
Love it. You get a different experience when you go into a Lush store, don't you? It's quite the...
Many people say to me, I just can't bear the smell. Mm. I just thought it was an extraordinary place. And it was a happy place. Mm. It was a really, really happy place to be. And it was soap and it was glitter and it was colours.
Love it.
And there was no ovens.
No ovens or freezers. Freezers. Our final question. I think this is my favourite question. I had about 3 people ask me this one from just a very small snapshot that I was taking. The question is particularly, what about that buttery biscuit base?
Great. That's 11 years old.
Can you explain what it was to those who are not
sure?
Of course.
Okay, there was a guy, online guy, creative guy, and his handle was Swede Mason.
And he took clips of me and John Turode tasting food on MasterChef and put it with a kind of beat.
Bit of a beat.
Yeah. I don't want to say disco because I don't think it is disco. And I don't know what the other things are. I don't know what house is. I don't know what jungle is. I know the words, but I don't know what they are. He put a beat behind it. And I was tasting a cheesecake. And it's a cheesecake has a buttery biscuit base. Mm. But he did it and kept cutting it so it sounded like a rap. So it was me going, I love the bass, biscuit base. I love the buttery biscuit base. And when I first saw it, I thought, that is absolute genius. And it was Greg James. You know me and Greg James of Radio 1 are mates. We weren't back then. Greg James was doing Drive Time. He found it. He started playing it. And it just went crazy. It got into the top 40. All revenues went to charity. Got into the top 40. I met Professor Green. He was like, mate, me and you, we're rap artists. And fist pump me. mate, the buttery biscuit base. So I was very, very proud of it. What really interests me is people still send me a clip of it. Less now, but I reckon at least half a dozen times a year still. Go, have you seen this? Yeah.
Yeah.
After 11 years, I definitely have seen this, yeah.
Oh, brilliant. If you haven't checked it out, do go onto YouTube and have a look at it.
Or Google buttery biscuit base and just have a look. It's really clever.
Love it. Okay, we're coming to the end, sadly, of our time on this podcast. But where can our listeners find out more about you, listen to you more? You've got a podcast that's newly out as well. But yeah, just give us the
Very, very generous of you. Can I also mention my Uncle Ted's Laundrette in Lewisham, because he's doing service washes off price now on a Wednesday.
There we go. That's very
And could I ask everyone, could you keep watching me on the telly? Because my wife wants to get the kitchen done.
Okay.
But right, okay.
So those two are in the bank now.
Thank you very much.
Other places.
So I have a podcast called A Piece of Cake, Greg Wallace, where I interview experts in health and wellness, and you can get that on Spotify, you can get that on the global player, you can actually get it on the landing page of my website, free to download. My website is Greg Wallace Health, and on there you'll find hundreds of healthy recipes and advice from medical experts, and I'm really proud of it.
Well, it's been great to have you on. As a final question, if you were to sell your interest, you know, in healthy eating, healthy lifestyles to the next generation, those are looking up and saying sort of like, what do I want to do with my life? What would you say to inspire that next generation?
What, to be healthier?
For them to be interested in a healthy lifestyle, let's say.
It is your life. It's your life. It's not a rehearsal. Why not be the best version of yourself that you can be? Why not be skipping around like a spring lamb? Why not wear the clothes that you really want to wear? Why not be able to sprint up a hill? Why not be able to swim across a lake? Why be anything else? How could anything else be worth it? And all you've got to do is eat properly. That's all you've got to do. You should be a hobby of yourself. You should be an all-consuming hobby. Work on you like you are looking after your body for somebody else. If your body could choose what it wanted to eat and drink, what would it choose? Look after you. Make you your hobby.
I love that.
Greg, how's that?
I think that's fantastic, but I would love it. Do you have a joke to leave us on? Because you've got so many jokes out there. Is there one that's on the top of your mind right now?
Does visual work?
Go on.
To which camera?
Middle camera.
Middle camera? What is this?
Don't know, Greg.
That is a pea on a fork.
And there we have it. Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. If you've liked the episode, then feel free to like or subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. And you can also check out our other podcast, Experts in Sport, as well. So once again, thanks so much for tuning in. And I look forward to welcoming you back to another health-related podcast in a future episode. Bye-bye for now.
You are a really good presenter. I can't believe you do that without auto-cue. Isn't he good?
Thank you.